Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 165 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I have episode 165. I'm going to be talking about a cardiology for the USMLE Step 1 exam. Although, to be honest, if you're struggling with cardiology for the Step 2 CK exam, this will not be a bad podcast to listen to. Well, basically, this is going to be a cardiology review, and this is going to be part 3. This is a continuation of episode 154, which is part 2. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has a history of like Down syndrome, right? And they tell you that, oh, you hear like murmurs in the patient's heart. What kind of congenital heart defect does this person likely have? Well, I hope you're telling me like an endocardial Cushing defect. Remember, endocardial Cushing defects are the most common heart defects in patients that have a history of Down syndrome, right? And hopefully you remember the other sequelae that are associated with Down syndrome, right? So Down syndrome tends to be associated with like the epicanthal folds, right? Tends to be associated with the single palmar crease, right? Down syndrome also has an association with like duodenal atresia, right? So if they give you a question about a kid that has bilious vomiting and you see like the double bubble on imaging on like a radiograph, you know that you're dealing with Down syndrome, duodenal atresia. And remember that that occurs from a failure of recanalization. And then remember that Down syndrome is also associated with annular pancreas, right? So again, that can actually also be a cause of bilious vomiting on an MBME exam with like chronic small bowel obstruction and maybe like even pancreatitis in a kid, right? And then one of the things you think about Down syndrome is like Hirschsprung's disease, right? Where they have like a colonic aganglionosis. So that causes like chronic constipation, failure to pass meconium and things of that nature. So those are all high yield things to keep at the back of your mind. And remember, right, Down syndrome is obviously a trisomy 21. And those kids, remember, Down syndrome, they also have an increased risk of ALL, right? So ALL, remember this mnemonic, right? They all fall down, right? That's a classic mnemonic that's in many resources, right? They all fall down to help you remember that there's an increased risk of ALL in kids that have Down syndrome. And then another thing you may also see with Down syndrome on MBME exams is you may also see the association with early Alzheimer's, right? Because remember the one of the genes that plays a role in the development of Alzheimer's disease is on chromosome 21. So it's almost like the person has like a triple dose of the badness, right? So that can easily put them in trouble. Now, what if you get a question on the exam about a patient that presents with like severe, like tearing chest pain, and it's radiating to the back? What are you thinking about under those circumstances? What diagnosis are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about aortic dissection, right? Aortic dissection. Remember, aortic dissection is pretty bad, has a actually pretty higher mortality. And I mean, it has some classic ways it presents on exams, right? So usually, it'll be a person that has like, you know, like severe tearing chest pain. Although sometimes they may not have like the severe tearing chest pain radiating to the back. They may just have chest pain. But the thing is, there are some other classic antecedents that your friends at the MBME like to throw on exams in terms of, oh, this is how this stuff presents, right? So some ways it can present is, so they'll have like, you know, the chest pain, or you may see people have like differences in blood pressure between the arms, right? Because the thing is, as you're having the dissection, you may begin to have involvement of a subclavian artery. So you begin to hypoperfuse one of the upper extremities, right? So you have those differential blood pressures in the arms. And then one other thing you may also see is like a widened mediastinum on a chest x-ray, right? So widened mediastinum, that's a classic imaging finding. Occasionally, they may even give you a person that has like, you know, like severe chest pain, and they tell you that the person has a pleural effusion, like a unilateral pleural effusion. If you see that, that's another classic presentation of aortic dissection on MBME exams. And the thing is, usually when a person has aortic dissection, right, you know, they'll usually give you like some kind of risk factor. So the risk factor in like young people, right, it tends to be like, you know, like if they have some kind of like weird connective tissue disorder, so like people that have like Marfan's. Remember, Marfan's is a chromosome 15 defect in fibrillin, autosomal dominant inheritance, or they may have like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, right? Remember, Ehlers-Danlos, it's a defect in collagen. Some kinds of Ehlers-Danlos, especially I think the vascular Ehlers-Danlos, is a defect in type 3 collagen, right? Although there's some other Ehlers-Danlos that's also associated with a defect in type 5 collagen, right? So people that have like Marfan's, people that have Ehlers-Danlos, those conditions tend to be associated with aortic dissection, especially in young people. There are, again, many other connective tissue disorders, even like bicuspid aortic valve. So if they give you a question about a patient with a history of Turner syndrome that's having like severe, again, chest pain, yada, 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 think about aortic dissection, right? Because bicuspid aortic valve is a big risk factor for aortic dissection, okay? And bicuspid aortic valve, in addition to coarctation of the aorta, right, are the two classic heart problems associated with people that have Turner syndrome. And then, remember, right, if a person, you know, has all these other things like Takayasu's arteritis or giant cell arteritis, those things, basically anything that can cause an aortitis, so inflammation of the aorta, so like giant cell, Takayasu's, syphilis, remember tertiary syphilis, right, tends to involve the aorta, right, because remember that in syphilis, T. pallidum, especially in the tertiary stage, loves to scrub the vasa vasorum of the like ascending aorta, right? So that can cause aortic dissection in that regard. And then ankylosing spondylitis, right? RA, so like rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, those things are all associated with the those things can all cause an aortitis, and that can all trigger aortic dissection. Well, the one thing you want to remember is that the biggest risk factor for aortic dissection is hypertension. That is something that classically shows up on exams, especially on step 2. But the thing is, they're also beginning to test these risk factors on step 1. So it's one of those weird things you want to try to commit to memory. So hypertension is the biggest, very high yield. Hypertension is the biggest risk factor for aortic dissection. So what causes aortic dissection, right? So typically happens in people that may have like already have like an aortic aneurysm or something of that nature. But basically you have like a tear in the intima, right? Remember, right, the aorta is a big large muscular artery, right? So it has the three layers, has like the intima, has the media, has the adventitia. So you have a tear in the intima, and when you have that tear in the intima, blood will track along that tear and track through the media, right? Track through the media, right? So inside that media you ultimately create like a false lumen. But the thing is, that false lumen, as it grows and expands, it can compress the true lumen of the aorta, and then that can cause hypoperfusion of like the brain, so people can get strokes in the setting of aortic dissection. Or you can like have the blood like track proximally to like the pericardial sac, so people can get cardiac tamponade from aortic dissection. That's one of the reasons why you can see a widened mediastinum on imaging. Or you can have like the dissection track back to like a coronary vessel. But remember, your coronary vessel can arise, coronary vessels, they arise around the area of the aortic cusps, right? So if it tracks back to your coronary vessels, especially the right carotid artery, that's probably the most commonly involved coronary vessel in aortic dissection. So if it tracks back to those coronary vessels, right, person can obviously get a myocardial infarction. And sometimes people can get like really bad aortic regurge from aortic dissection. So those are all things you can see, right? So that's why aortic dissection is bad. It's just the extension of the dissection that tends to cause many of the symptoms. And then under some unfortunate circumstances, people can have like really bad aortic dissection where it just extends, and then you rupture the aortic wall. That's obviously terrible, right? Because, I mean, most of those people don't survive. It's just a bad situation all around. So the thing is, aortic dissection, you want to be able to break it up into its two major types. I mean, there are many classification systems, but the one you will likely see on your exam is the Stanford classification, right? And the thing is, there is something called the Stanford A classification, and then there's the Stanford B classification. Basically, Stanford B means that it's only the descending aorta that is involved, okay? Stanford B just tells you that it's only the descending aorta that is involved. But if the ascending aorta is involved in any way, shape, or form, then you know that you're dealing with a Stanford type A dissection. The reason you have to differentiate these two things is that there are differences in treatment, right? So, like a Stanford type B dissection, all you need is medical therapy, right? But a Stanford type A dissection, you need medical therapy plus surgery, okay? So that's the key difference you want to lock down in your mind. So you may say, oh, Divine, what do you mean by medical therapy? The thing is, if a person ever has aortic dissection, your first step in management, and again, if you're like a second year medical student, I promise you, you probably see this question at least 10 to 20 times before you graduate from med school. But, and this is like on USMLE exams, class exams, and all that stuff. If a person has aortic dissection that has been confirmed, your first step in management is always medical therapy with a beta blocker. Okay, it can be any kind of beta blocker, even labetalol. Remember, labetalol is an alpha beta blocker that is okay for aortic dissection, right? So your first step is always a beta blocker. If maybe they really wanted to stretch your thinking on the exam, although they rarely do this, but if a beta blocker is not caught in it, right, then one thing you can consider is to give like a sodium nitroprusside. Right, it's like a powerful vasodilator. Again, you cannot just give any vasodilator. You can't like say, oh, take hydralazine. No, giving hydralazine is actually going to worsen the patient's outcome in aortic dissection, so you don't want to do that, right? So first, always give a beta blocker. Always give a beta blocker first. That is extremely critical to know for the USMLE exams. You give a beta blocker first, because the reason you do that is there is like some physiologic mechanisms behind that. But I feel like I have a lot of stuff to cover, so I'm not necessarily going to like jump into that today. But essentially, you don't want a person to have, you want to minimize tachycardia as much as possible when a person has aortic dissection. Because if they have tachycardia, that will increase the shear stress on the walls of the aorta, and that will worsen the dissection, right? So you don't want to do anything that will raise the patient's heart rate. That's why typically you give a beta blocker first, right? But if you're like, oh, you know what, let me give a vasodilator like hydralazine or something, even the nitroprusside I said is acceptable. If you give that first, right, that will cause like a massive vasodilation, right? The way your heart responds to massive vasodilation, right, through those baroreceptor mechanisms I've described in other podcasts, is you have like a reflex tachycardia, and that will worsen the dissection. So you always give the beta blockers first, right? And then if you're dealing with a type E dissection, you can then also proceed with going to surgery, right? So call vascular surgery or whatever, and then they will hopefully be able to fix the problem. Now, aortic dissection, right? How do you like make the diagnosis? Again, classically on imaging, you'll see like a widened mediastinum, right? But obviously, you want to confirm it. You don't just want to go and open a person's chest and do whatever, right? So classically for aortic dissection, you can do like a CT angiogram, right? That's usually the right answer on MBME exams. You get a CT angiogram, it'll show you the dissection beautifully. The reason that you do the CT angiogram is it will help you like evaluate, oh, is the cause of this patient's chest pain aortic dissection or something else, right? Something else can mean like another acute aortic syndrome, like an intramural hematoma or things of that nature. Or it can show you if the patient has a PE or something weird that's also causing their chest pain. What if you know the patient is like crashing, not doing well? You can do an echocardiogram. You can do like a TTE. Although that's not as good as a TEE, right? So remember, a transthoracic echocardiogram is not as sensitive as a transesophageal echocardiogram, right? So it's not as great, but usually you can do a TTE on MBME exams and that'll be correct. But if you don't see TTE as an answer choice, you can go with TEE, okay? Transesophageal echocardiogram. Those are all things you do when the patient is crashing. But if the patient is not crashing, patient is relatively hemodynamically stable, you can go ahead and get a CT angiogram. That study doesn't take as much time, especially with the advent of these really fast CT scanners. So those are all big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with aortic dissection. Again, don't forget, the biggest risk factor for aortic dissection is hypertension. That is something that your friends at the MBME love to test quite frequently. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that has, like a 75-year-old guy, and they tell you that he has passed out like two or three times while mowing his lawn. And they tell you that on auscultation of the chest, you hear like this systolic ejection murmur radiating to the carotids. What's your diagnosis? That's aortic stenosis, right? That's aortic stenosis. Really, for these heart murmur questions, right? I have like some dedicated podcasts where I've talked about like just murmurs. Like I think it's probably one of my earliest podcasts on this website, maybe like episode 4. Like right around there. Well, there's this podcast where I go into like extreme detail on the physiology of murmurs and like the pathophys behind many of the findings. It's probably one of the best podcasts I've ever made. So if you know, if you're interested and you really want to like dig deep into murmurs, it's not a bad podcast to listen to. But basically, right, this person has aortic stenosis, right? And the thing is really for these murmurs, to be honest, the big things you just want to remember is, are they systolic or diastolic, right? What do different maneuvers do to these murmurs? And again, many of these things make perfect sense if you just kind of think about it. Many people just try to memorize a random crap, but you don't need to do any of those, right? So just think, is this systolic or diastolic? Where is it hurt best? And then you also want to, again, know about your different maneuvers, right? And the thing is for the maneuvers, I think the smartest thing to learn with your maneuvers is, does this maneuver increase preload or afterload, right? Because for most of the murmurs, all you need to understand is, oh, if I increase preload, what will happen to this murmur? If I decrease afterload or increase afterload, yada, 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 what will happen to this murmur? So those are all kind of like the big things you want to remember with your murmurs. Now, one thing I want to go ahead and say is there's this thing called Carvalho's sign, right, that can really help you with murmurs. Like if a murmur gets accentuated with inspiration, you know you're dealing with a right-sided heart murmur. You can essentially like take that to the bank, rule out many answers relatively quickly on MBME exams. So if a murmur gets worse with inspiration, that's known as Carvalho's sign. That's classic for a right-sided heart murmur. Because right when you inspire, right, what happens to your venous return? It would increase. So if your venous return increases, that would increase flow or flux through whatever right-sided heart valve, right? So that would likely make the murmur get louder. Okay, so again, that's a big thing to keep in mind. And then right, you want to remember like where certain murmurs are heard best, right? So like there's this there are many mnemonics you may see. You may see like the mnemonic apartment M, like APTM, or all physicians take money, or I don't know, just find whatever mnemonic that works for you. But basically in the right upper sternal border, you hear aortic murmurs best. Left upper sternal border, you hear pulmonic murmurs best. Left lower sternal border, you hear tricuspid murmurs best. And then at the apex, right, basically like around the ear where you should palpate the point of maximal impulse, right? That's where you hear mitral murmurs best. Now, the thing is, that left lower sternal border is also where you hear VSD really well. And that's also where you hear the murmur of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy pretty well. And that's also where you hear the murmur of aortic regurge pretty well, right? And you know, some people say, Divine, aortic regurge, how is that? Remember, the aorta takes off from the left side of the heart and goes towards the right side of the body, right? Like as it's going upwards to form the arch, it goes towards the right side of the body. So if you think about it, if blood is regurgitating back, right? That means blood is flowing backwards. So blood is flowing back from whence it came. So it's flowing from the right side up high to the left side down low. That's why it's heard best at the left lower sternal border. Really, for many of these murmurs, if you just sort of track the flow, the places where they are heard best kind of makes a lot of sense. So those are big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with these murmurs. And again, these things, like people try to memorize, or which murmurs are systolic, which murmurs are diastolic. Again, you don't need to do that. Just analyze what that chamber of the heart is doing, and you should be golden for the most part. So the patient I talked about earlier, right, clearly has aortic stenosis. If you see like a murmur in a person that's in their 70s on MBME exams, almost like 99% of the time, it's aortic stenosis. In fact, many times, if they give me like the audio, whatevers, I don't even bother listening to those because the answer is usually, you know, like pretty obvious. So person has aortic stenosis, right? And remember, the buzzword pathophysiology behind aortic stenosis is calcification of the valve. So it's calcification roundabout, be it if you're in your 50s or in your 60s, in your 70s, it doesn't matter. But one high yield thing to remember is that the most common cause, very high yield, the most common cause of aortic stenosis before the age of 70 is a bicuspid aortic valve, okay? But past the age of 70, you have like just the senile calcification. And again, remember, bicuspid aortic valve has an association with Turner syndrome. That's one factoid I've already repeated multiple times. And really, aortic stenosis, right, the classic boss phrase, right, they may say that, oh, the person has a crescendo decrescendo. They may say the person has a diamond-shaped systolic ejection murmur radiating to the carotids, right? If you see that, think about aortic stenosis. And again, there are some other things you can see with aortic stenosis, right? Like you may see like the pulsus pravus etardus, right? Because again, think about it, right? If you have a lot of trouble getting blood out of the left ventricle, because you have a stenotic valve. Obviously, that's going to go ahead and cause problems with getting enough blood early. So like when you hear the heartbeat, when you feel the heartbeat in, you're like, oh, okay, this person is in systole right now. Well, you're checking the cardiac pulse, you're like, man, it's taking a long time for this. This cardiac pulse is kind of like taking its sweet time, right? Like it's like almost like tardy. It's like, remember the word tardy means late, right? So it's like a late tardy pulse. That's what they call a pulsus or parvus eternus. Okay, so that's a classic buzzword association with aortic stenosis. And remember that aortic stenosis, right, they can have like there are these three things, and I remember them with the mnemonic ASH, right? They can have like angina, so like chest pain from aortic stenosis. They can have syncope, right? That's the S. They can have heart failure like symptoms. Basically, the reason I give those three things is once you start having those sequelae from aortic stenosis, you do need to go ahead and replace the valve, because these people are very likely to die within a few months to like a year or two if care is not taken. And obviously, in order of bad to worse, right, like if you have heart failure symptoms, you'll be dead within a couple of months, right? If you have syncope from aortic stenosis, you'll be dead within like maybe like a year, right? But if you have angina, you'll probably be dead within like 3, 4, 5 years, right? So an aortic stenosis, you don't really, there's not many options available for you. You just need to go ahead and replace the valve. Okay, so that's a classic thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for the USMLEs. And again, if you're thinking in terms of maneuvers, right, again, the murmur will be louder if there's more flow through the valve, right? So if you increase preload, right, there'll be more left ventricular and diastolic volume. So you have more flow across the stenotic valve, the murmur will sound louder, right? But think about it. If you decrease the afterload, that will also accomplish the same effect, right? Because if you decrease afterload, it will be easier for blood to flow across the aortic valve, right? So again, that will make the murmur sound louder, right? On the flip side, if you increased afterload, right? If you increased afterload, the gradient between the left ventricle and the aorta will be diminished, right? And remember, right, you need the more gradient you have, the more flow you have. So if you have less gradient, you have less flow. So if you have less flow, right, you have less flow across the stenotic aortic valve, and you won't have it will sound softer. Okay, so again, those are, you know, just easy, quick, high yield things to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they give you like the person's blood pressure is like, I don't know, like 150 over 40, and the person, they tell you that this person has been having like has a history of like dilated cardiomyopathy, or they may tell you this person has a history of like an aortic aneurysm, what kind of murmur are you thinking about? This is clearly aortic regurg, right? I mean, the blood pressure, like, again, many times when you get this audio questions on the USMLEs, again, I typically will say that you can almost always answer them correctly without even listening to the audio. So typically my trick is, again, to look out for key things, right? So a blood pressure of 150 over 40, right? That's kind of weird, right? So this is not very normal, right? So that's something you likely see in aortic regurg, right? And that thing I'm referring to is a white pulse pressure. White pulse pressure is pathognomonic for aortic regurg. Although another murmur it's pathognomonic for an MBM exams is a patent ductus arteriosus, okay? So if you see like a white pulse pressure in a kid, that's likely PDA. If you see a white pulse pressure in an adult, it's likely aortic regurg. And one thing just kind of dropped in my mind, so let me go ahead and talk about it so I don't forget. So remember that I said that for aortic stenosis, right, the buzzword pathophysiology you want to remember is calcification of the valve, right? For aortic dissection, which I just mentioned a few minutes ago, the buzzword pathophysiology you want to remember is cystic medial necrosis. Okay, cystic medial necrosis. Sometimes you may see cystic medial degeneration, right? And then another classic buzzword that your friends at the MBME love you to remember is the buzzword for mitral valve prolapse, which I'll talk about shortly. Well, mitral valve prolapse, I want to remember myxomatous degeneration. Okay, you may say, Divine, where are you manufacturing these words from? I promise you these words are very high yield words to know on exams. So aortic regurg, right, again, white pulse pressure together with a patent ductus arteriosus, right? So you may say, okay, what causes aortic regurg? Essentially, anything that can widen the aortic root will cause aortic regurg, right? So for a person has like, again, essentially many of the risk factors for aortic dissection are kind of like the same risk factors for aortic regurg, right? So like, again, bicuspid aortic valve, tertiary syphilis, Takayasu's, giant cell, all that stuff. right? And there are some weird things that, like weird physical exam findings that your friends at the MBA may occasionally throw on exams, right? So they may have like a head bobbing, right? So people may have like head bobbing, they may have like the quinky pulse. So they may tell you that, oh, when you look at their nail bed or you palpate their nail bed, you can see like pulsations. Or they may tell you that they have like a water hammer pulse. Really, many of these physical exam findings, they arise because the patient has a white pulse pressure. So you may say, Divine, what causes the white pulse pressure in aortic regurg? Well, not rocket science, actually. So the thing that actually causes the white pulse pressure is, if you think about it, if a person has aortic regurgitation, right? First thing that happens is, obviously, it's a diastolic murmur, right? So the classic description is, oh, it's a diastolic blowing murmur, right? So diastolic blowing murmur. So the thing that happens in aortic regurg is that blood will flow backwards, right? From the aorta to the left ventricle during diastole, right? So the thing is, think about it. If the blood that is supposed to be packed in the aorta during diastole, if some of it has made its way back to the left ventricle, that means the amount of blood in the aorta in diastole will be diminished. So if that's diminished, that means that your diastolic blood pressures go down, right? So diastolic blood pressures go down for that reason. Now, think about it. If more blood is flowing back to the left ventricle, what happens to the left ventricular end diastolic volume with the next run of the cardiac cycle? It goes up, right? So the left ventricular end diastolic volume goes up. And if that goes up, that means, if you're again thinking in terms of the Frank Starlinger mechanism, right? If your left ventricular end diastolic volume goes up, that means you have more blood to eject with the next systolic beat of the heart, right? So those people's stroke volumes will be higher, and that will raise systolic blood pressure. So essentially, if you notice in a person that has aortic dissection, the systolic blood pressure is rising, the diastolic blood pressure is decreasing, right? So that will obviously widen the pulse pressure, right? Because hopefully you remember that pulse pressure is the difference between systolic and diastolic blood pressures. So it's that widening of the pulse pressure that is responsible for many of the physical exam findings you have. Because especially like those water hammer pulses, it just really arises because you have like an increased left ventricular in diastolic volume from the regurg, right? So your stroke volume goes up a ton. So your cardiac output goes up quite a bit. So your systolic blood pressure increases, okay? That's what causes many of those physical exam findings you observe in aortic regurgitation. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient that's from like a developing country, and this patient has a history of like an upper respiratory infection that was not really treated, kind of resolved on its own, and then they tell you that, oh, you are now hearing like a diastolic murmur at the apex, right? And maybe the person has like an irregular interval on an EKG, right? Hopefully under these circumstances, you're thinking more along the lines of mitral stenosis, right? Remember, the biggest risk factor for mitral stenosis is a rheumatic fever, okay? The biggest risk factor for mitral stenosis is rheumatic fever. They love to test that on exams. And remember that mitral stenosis is the biggest risk factor for AFib. So the most common arrhythmia in a person that has a history of mitral stenosis is AFib, right? Because the left atrium will obviously dilate if a person has a AFib, right? So the thing is, when a person has a mitral stenosis, right, they tend to have, again, like dilation of the left atrium, right? So that can cause a AFib. And the thing is, as the left atrium actually dilates, it can actually begin to compress the esophagus. Because remember, right, the left atrium is like the most posterior chamber in the heart, and literally like the esophagus is like smack dab against the left atrium. So the thing is, whenever a person has like left atrial enlargement, that can actually go ahead and compress the esophagus, right? And the person can have dysphagia from that, right? And another clinical correlate with that is why we do something called a TEE. That is why a TEE is more sensitive than a TTE, right? Because in the transesophageal echocardiogram, you're like smack dab, right? Because you're literally putting the, you know, the ultrasound probe in the person's esophagus, right? So the thing is, you're like smack dab against the left atrial wall, right? So, you know, it works pretty well. That's why it's more sensitive. So that's, I guess, something to keep at the back of your mind. And again, I already described this. If you increase preload, right? In fact, I'll reference those podcasts in the comments, like in the description of this podcast. But I'm fairly certain it's one of my early podcasts on this website. I described like the different maneuvers, like again, the pathophys behind those and how they like modulate these cardiac murmurs. So I will make reference to that when I'm writing like the comments below the podcast name. But in general, if you increase preload, right, or you decrease afterload, right, that will make, although really for mitral stenosis, they tend to test it more in terms of like increased preload. If you increase preload, there'll be more flow across the stenotic valve. And again, the murmur will sound louder. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, that you hear like a holosystolic murmur at the apex, right? This is obviously a mitral regurg, right? And mitral regurg, for whatever reason, on MBME exams, they love to put it in women that are recently like pregnant, right? That's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then remember that mitral regurg can also be caused by like if you're like a person that has like a recent MI and they rupture one of those papillary muscles, right? That can cause a mitral regurg. And if, for example, a person has like a history of like dilated cardiomyopathy, that can also cause mitral regurg, right? Because when you have dilated cardiomyopathy, the left ventricle kind of dilates. And if it dilates, right, you will essentially pull the mitral valve leaflets apart, right? And that can cause mitral regurg. So that's one of just those like weird, bizarre things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. But again, mitral regurg, right, it's a holosystolic murmur heard best at the apex. And the thing is, the murmur actually increases in intensity when you have an increase in preload, right? And also when you have an increase in afterload. Right, so we have an increase in preload or an increase in afterload, that'll make the murmur sound louder, right? And that should hopefully make sense, because if you have more blood in the left ventricle, that would essentially give you more blood to regurgitate backwards, right? So anything that increases preload will put more blood in the left ventricle. Anything that increases afterload, right, will prevent blood from leaving the left ventricle, so there'll be more blood in the left ventricle, so you have a louder murmur. So again, those are all things to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And I guess a closely related murmur is like mitral valve prolapse. Mitral valve prolapse, really, the classic way we present, right? They will describe like, they will tell you that this person has like murmur with like a mid-systolic click, right? And again, typically it's found in people that have all these connective tissue diseases like Marfan's or like Ehlers-Danlos, right? Or people that have like psychiatric disorders, okay? Those people tend to have a mitral valve prolapse on MBME exams, right? So those are just all like, again, weird, bizarre things you want to keep at the back of your mind on tests. And then mitral valve prolapse, again, I have described the pathophysiology in a different podcast, but I'll just give you the Cliff's Notes version here. But basically, whenever you have more blood in the left ventricle, the murmur will sound softer because the prolapse of the valves is decreased by putting more blood in the left ventricle. So actually, if you increased preload or you increased afterload, that will actually make the murmur of mitral valve prolapse sound softer. Again, I've described this in many other podcasts. So, and again, I'll make reference to those podcasts in the comment section. So, I don't think I'm going to like just keep beating the bush here. And again, so mitral valve prolapse. So let me just go over these murmur descriptors real quick, right? So aortic stenosis, crescendo, decrescendo, systolic ejection murmur, heard best at the right upper sternal border, radiating to the carotids, pulsus privus tardus, right? Mitral valve prolapse, right? It's a murmur with a mid-systolic click, right? Heard best at the apex in a person with a connective tissue disease or a psychiatric disorder on MBME exams, right? Mitral stenosis, person with a history of rheumatic fever, right? Diastolic murmur, heard best at the apex. The person may have AFib, right? The person may have dysphagia from left atrial enlargement and subsequent compression of the esophagus, right? And then and mitral stenosis, right? They will describe like diastolic murmur opening snap, right? So that's mitral stenosis. So I've talked about mitral stenosis. Mitral regurg is just holosystolic murmur heard best at the apex with radiation to the axilla, right? Those are, again, these are all like the classic descriptors that they occasionally may put on exams. Although in my experience, your friends at the MBME are beginning to, you know, like shy away from doing that on tests. Aortic regurg rate, again, will be like the diastolic murmur, diastolic blowing murmur, heard best at the left lower sternal border. And again, the patient will have like a white pulse pressure, and you'll have all these like weird physical exam findings like head bobbing, water hammer pulse, squinky pulse, like there's like this Dorisi sign and all that stuff. But those are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, I have like a very big treatment of the pathophys behind like the maneuvers and the murmurs in a different podcast. And again, I'll point you to that in the conclusion. So as I do at the end of every podcast, right, I mean, if you're a med student, you're taking any exam, I likely tutor for that exam. So like step one, step two CK, two CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, like the medicine boards, like the medicine training exam, EBIM board exam, I tutor for all those. And then I do this longitudinal tutoring thing that I've talked about ad nauseum at this point, where if you're a first, second, or third year med student, I tutor you for like your shelf exams or like your class exams. But at the same time, I tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exams. And again, that has been wildly successful. People have done that with. And then I do this booster course, right, where it's like 10 hours for step 2 CK and step 3 and 20 hours for step 1, where, again, if you're at the end of your dedicated period or you've... you've covered the material and feel good about your knowledge base, it's like a quick period to put everything together in a Q&A format, where we essentially go over like a lot of the high yield stuff you'll likely see on your exam. I do that on a one-on-one basis. And then if you need coaching, right, for like if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, feel free to reach out to me. Like personal statements, rec letters, editing applications, mock interviews, those are things I'm extremely good at. Most of the people I've worked with have matched at their first choices. And again, I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for like a year, right? So again, I have a ton of experience reviewing thousands and thousands of high quality applications. So if that's something you're interested in, either send me an email, divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com, or you can just reach out to me through the website and I'll catch an email from you. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I will continue this cardiology series. God bless you, and I'll see you next time. Thank you.